today is from Judges chapter 16, verse 1 through 6. I will begin the reading with the odd verse. Samson and Delilah. One day Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. But Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate, together with the two posts, and tore them loose, bar and all. He lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." We welcome Pastor Tan.
Father was a man of few words, but what little he said, I remember them all. He used to tell me about the Maginot Line when I was a little boy. Now the Maginot Line is named after André Maginot. He was a French minister of war 80 years ago, and he pushed hard for the construction of this Maginot Line between 1930 and 1940. Now, the Maginot Line is a formidable series of defensive fortifications between France and Germany, all the way from Switzerland to Luxembourg, also from the Alps down to the Mediterranean, too, facing Italy. There were many massive forts and bunkers and fortifications a few miles apart, and they were connected to each other through underground tunnels. Only a very small part of these forts and bunkers are visible above ground, because most of the bunkers, most of the forts were hidden underground, being protected by the earth itself. And the front entrances were protected by massive concrete walls, many feet thick. Inside were state-of-the-art weaponries, massive big guns, many stories of barracks and magazine for storing shells, and hospitals and command posts. They were serviced by elevators. They were connected by underground railroad, and they were even air-conditioned. The French put all their resources into constructing this massive line of fortification against their traditional enemy, the Germans. And sure enough, war broke out in 1939. But after the conquest of Poland, the Germans did nothing. For 6 months, the Germans just sat there and did nothing. And newspaper began to say that this is only a phony war. And the French began to think to themselves, we are safe. This Maginot Line of ours is so strong. Our forts, our defenses, so impregnable, so indestructible. And the enemies could never gain a foothold in our sacred soil of France. So the French fooled themselves into thinking they were safe. But then their self-deception was shattered. The Germans struck. And when the Germans struck, they struck with lightning ferocity. On May 10, 1940, the Germans invaded. And just in a matter of a few days, the Germans occupied Luxembourg, Belgium, and Holland. And in 2 weeks, the Germans trapped 300,000 or more English troops at Dunkirk. And 2 more weeks later, the Germans occupied Paris. And 1 week after that, the French capitulated and the French signed the armistice. And that is just a euphemism for surrender. What happened? How could such a strong, impregnable, indestructible line of defense not able to expel, not able to repel the enemies? Because the Maginot Line had a fatal flaw. It only extended from Switzerland to Luxembourg, and it stopped there. It left the French border with Belgium wide open with little defenses. Well, we ask, why not extend the Maginot Line all the way to the English Channel? Because the French thought it was unnecessary. Because the French thought that the Germans could never, ever penetrate the Ardennes forest in Belgium. Because the French thought the Germans would never, ever invade Belgium, that was a neutral country. The Germans did mount an attack against the Maginot Line, but it was only a diversionary attack. The Maginot Line was never broken. My son Joseph and I were there just a few weeks ago, and I commented to my son, and I said, "Son, too bad it didn't work." There was an Englishman next to me, they were visiting too, and he corrected me and he said, "It did work." Because the Germans never broke through the Maginot Line. But the bulk of the German army did exactly what the French thought they could not ever do and what they would not do. The Germans penetrated the Ardennes, swept down Belgium, and took Paris in 5 weeks. A few French commanders wanted to hold out. After all, the French Maginot Line was still intact. But it was all useless. Why? Because the Germans now occupied France. They were now behind the Maginot Line and not in front of it. Well, we say, why couldn't the French then turn the guns around? Even the Germans were behind, turn the guns around, but they couldn't. Because the guns were all fixed in one direction. All facing north and all facing east. All facing toward Germany. They thought the defenses were so strong. They thought the defenses were so indestructible and impregnable. They thought the Germans could never and would never able to outflank them and get behind them. And that's how they were defeated in 6 weeks. And so began years of shame and years of pain and years of misery. Now, I did not tell you the story to entertain you, but to remind us all in our Christian life, beware of this marginal mentality. We may be lulled into spiritual complacency. We may be lulled into thinking that we are so strong in spirituality, thinking that our faith is so impregnable, our love for God so indestructible, our service to God so unimpeachable. But just like the French behind the Maginot Line, we fail to realize the fatal flaws in our Christian life. Satan is our enemy. He will not mount a frontal attack against our faith in God. He will not mount a frontal attack against our love to God. He will not mount a frontal attack against our service to God. But just like the Germans, Satan will only mount a diversionary attack against our defenses. But he is forever probing the weak spots in our lives. He is forever probing our vulnerability, seeking the fatal flaws in our life, and outflank us and get behind our defenses and hand us terrible defeats in our faith and in our lives. Even the strongest among Christians are vulnerable to Satan's strategy. We are only as strong as our weakest fatal flaws. I want to study with you this morning a character in the Bible whose life was so tragic because he lived according to this Maginot mentality. Who is the strongest man? Who is the strongest character in the Bible? No, mom and dad don't say it. Brandon, who is the Brandon? Who is the strongest man in the Bible? Yes, did he say? Samson, thank you, Brandon. Remind me to make you a biggest dinner. Samson killed a lion with his bare hand. Not only did he kill the lion, the Bible tells us that he tore the lion apart as if he was tearing a little goat apart. He slaughtered 30 Philistines. He was bound by ropes and he just flexed his muscles and they all dropped off. He then picked up a jawbone of a donkey and he slew 1,000 Philistines. He tore off the gate of Gaza that we read a few minutes ago, and he lifted them on his shoulder and he carried it all the way to the top of the hill opposite Hebron. All the power and all the strength of Hercules, of Achilles, of Superman cannot match the strength and power of Samson. And yet at the end he died. He died under the rubble and ruin of the temple of his enemies. What a tragic life. He was no hero. He was a tragic figure. And there are three reasons I'd like to study with you this morning why Samson's life was so tragic. First of all, his life was so tragic because it was a wasted life. Samson's life began with great hope. You read a little earlier in chapter 13, verse 1, I'll read to you. Chapter 13 tells us that again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. Samson was born into a time of national decline and insecurity. Samson was born into a time of spiritual darkness. He was born into a time of moral degeneracy. Where is God when you needed him most? Where is the national Savior that God will send? And who will he be? And God says, Samson is the man. God says, I will use this man Samson to bring back security and bring back security and honor back to my people. When God says, Samson, you are the man, how could he not succeed? God says, Samson, you are the man, through the angels in chapter 13. And not only did God preordain Samson to succeed, look at the godly parents and look at the godly upbringing that Samson had. Verse 8 in chapter 13 tells us that his father Manoah prayed to the Lord. Oh Lord, I beg you. His father said, let the man of God you sent to us come back to teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born. Samson's father was asking God to send the angels back to him to teach him, to teach his wife, to teach the parents how to bring Samson up in a godly way. Samson's parents were committed to raise Samson up in God's way so that he can fulfill God's purpose and will in Samson's life. And this commitment is highlighted in the offering that Manoah made before God. Manoah, Samson's father, offered a goat and grain. Verse 19 in chapter 13 tells us that the Lord did an amazing things while Manoah and his wife were watching. Verse 20 tells us that as a flame blazed up from the altar toward heaven, and the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame. God is saying through that appearance, he is saying to Manoah and his wife, my favor is with you. Your commitment, your sacrifice, your offerings are acceptable to me. How could a child not grow up godly under such godly upbringing and parents and commitment? And what exactly is this commitment? Manoah and his father and wife was committed to raise Samson up as a Nazarite. Now what is a Nazarite? Look at verse 4, chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 4 tells us that God, the angel, is saying to the wife, now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. And no razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. And now what is this Nazarite business? The book of Numbers, chapter 6, tells us the Nazarites were those who had made vows before God, that they would set apart their lives to serve God. To emphasize the seriousness of dedication, to emphasize the seriousness of the commitment, they have to keep three prohibitions. Number one, they could not eat, they could not drink, they could not touch grapes, let alone wines and fermented alcoholic beverages. Two, they could not touch their bodies of any kind. And three, they could not cut their hair. And that is exactly what God is saying to Samson's parents through the angels. The child, this Samson, shall be special to me. He is set apart for me even before he was born. And he will begin the deliverance of Israel because he is my chosen servant. I was thinking, how could he not succeed? And not only that, chapter 13, verse 24 and 25 tells us that the woman, his mother, did give birth to a boy and named him Samson. And this Samson grew up, and verse 24 tells us that God blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in him while he was in Manhattan, Dan, between Zorah and Ashtal. Samson had God's promise. Samson had God's predestination that he is going to be a man that God will use. Samson had parents who were committed to the Lord, who brought him up to be special, who brought him up to be set apart for God's use. Samson has the Lord's blessing, and Samson had the presence of the Spirit with him. How could he not succeed? In the Old Testament, the Spirit of God did not come to people generously, did not come to God's people freely and generally, only to a very few and only occasionally. But Samson was given the Spirit of the Lord. Samson had all the man needed to succeed. Samson had all the spiritual advantages given him. There were so many could have in his life. He could have been. The most tragic of lives are lives that are full of could-haves. And then secondly, Samson's life was so tragic because he self-destructed. Could you see the self-destructive behavior of this most privileged boy? Number one, he went to the wrong places on his own. Verse 1, this is chapter 14 now. It begins by telling us that Samson went down to Timnah. Now, who told him to go down there? Nobody. He went down there himself. Timnah was enemy country. Timnah was Philistine country, just a few miles from his home village of Zorah. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that Samson is starting his downward slide into self-destruction. He may very well be a teenager of 15. I could imagine him being 7 foot tall, 300 pounds, all muscles and all brawn, but his hormone was raging. Now, I don't know how good-looking he was, but for sure, with his physique, he didn't even need to be good-looking. His body would have worn any girls in Philistine. And Samson is showing off his physical power in every way. And for his first debut, he leaves the land of Israel, and he is headed down into the land of Philistines. He is leaving godly spiritual influences, and he is heading down for disaster. And he continued his self-destructive ways by looking for the wrong things and demanding the wrong things. Verse 1 in chapter 14 tells us that Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine girl. Now, there's nothing wrong with seeing a girl. I mean, how can you not see a girl these days? It is what you do after you see a young woman that tells a lot about you. What did Samson do after seeing this young Philistine woman? Verse 2 in chapter 14 tells us that when he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I have seen the Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me for my wife." Samson may have been 7 foot tall. Samson may have been 300 pounds and all muscles and brawn. But I see 5 years old who never grew up. I cannot say anything about his father's parenting. The Bible didn't tell us. He might have been the most godly parents, but no matter how godly Manoah was, his godly wisdom did not produce any results. Samson sees something he wants, and he comes home, he demands it. Just like a little spoiled brat demanding candy and ice cream just before dinner. And Samson's parents comply. Verse 5 tells us that Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and mother. Yes, Samson's parents did protest earlier in verse 3. His father said, "What you want is not good and not right. There are so many acceptable women in Israel. Why do you have to go get an uncircumcised Philistine for a wife?" They protested very mildly and meekly and weakly, but they acquiesced at the end and they gave in. They lost the negotiation. A foreign visitor came to the United States. After he left, he said to his friends, he said, "I've never been to any country where parents are so obedient to their children." Samson's parents would qualify very well to be an obedient American parent. Yes, I'm also aware in verse 4, chapter 14 tells us that his parents did not know that this was from the Lord who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. Yes, all events are ordained and determined by God. Even our disobedience, even this disobedience of Samson. But we are never without the freedom to choose to do the right thing. And we are responsible for our disobedience. And Samson was responsible for his disobedience. And this is a paradox of God's providence. Samson was responsible for every step that he took on his downward slide to self-destruction. And this downward slide will only go further and further toward disaster, because Samson began to compromise his commitment of his life. A Nazarite could not drink any wine. A Nazarite could not drink any fermented drinks, not even wine vinegar that we put on our salad. He couldn't even drink grape juice. He couldn't even eat grapes. He couldn't even eat raisin. A Nazarite could not even get near a body, even the closest of his relatives. If his parents died, if his brother or sister died, he could not even go near him, the remain. And chapter 14 tells us that Samson had compromised these two commitments. Verse 5 tells us that on his way to marry this Philistine girl, Samson did not actually enter a vineyard. The Bible said he only approached the vineyards of Timnah. The Bible also tells us that, did not really tell us that actually touched a dead body. But how could he not touch a dead body when he actually and literally tore the lion apart to pieces? And then in verse 10 in chapter 14, the Bible tells us that Samson made a feast there, as was customary for bridegrooms. So he threw a bachelor party. And don't tell me, all they had to drink was mineral water. Samson had already compromised two of his commitments to God, and cutting his hair, the third, the last commitment, is only two chapters away. And because of time, we will not jump, and we will not dwell too much. We will jump ahead to chapter 16, where we find the final compromise. Samson lost his hair. Now, who has never heard of Samson and Delilah, right? Who has never heard of the story that Samson Delilah tricked Samson into telling her the secret? So I don't need to repeat the story, only to point out that Samson's downward slide to self-destruction began in chapter 14 and hit bottom in chapter 16. Delilah was Samson's third girlfriend, and she will be his femme fatale. Let's read verses 4 to 5 again. Chapter 16, the passage that we read earlier. Let's read verses 4 and 5 in chapter 16, please. Sometime later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him." Samson, we stop there. Samson's self-destruction was complete when he refused to recognize, no matter how strong, no matter how indestructible he may be, he was only as strong as his fatal flaw. Samson ignored his fatal flaws. The Philistine wanted Delilah to lure Samson into revealing his fatal flaw. The Hebrew word for lure literally means to find an opening, to find the vulnerable spot, to find the undefended spot, to find the Achilles heel, to find Superman's kryptonite. And just like the German who would not mount in front to attack against a strong Maginot line, they went around and they found the weak undefended border at Belgium. They brushed the English Channel and they find the opening to Paris, all because the French believed the German could not do it and would not do it. And so it was with Samson. Samson thought the same thing. The enemies could not and would not mount a frontal attack against him. And even if they did, they would not prevail. So they would lure him. They would seek out his fatal flaw. They would seek the opening of his life and brought him down and low. Samson's life was so tragic because it was so wasted. Samson's life was so tragic because it was self-destruction. And finally, the life of Samson was so tragic because it is being repeated again and again in the lives of so many Christians. Do you realize how privileged we were when we were born again in Christ? Our new birth in Jesus Christ was also an event preordained and predestined by God. Paul writes to the Ephesians in chapter 1. Paul says he predestined us to be adopted as God's Son through Jesus Christ. Our new birth, our privilege of being God's children, were an event planned and preordained by God. And so our life did not begin any differently from Samson. Just like Samson's life was preordained and predestined to be God's servant. When we were born again in Christ Jesus, our life was also set apart for the service and glory of God, just like Samson's was. Okay, we do not have to abstain from grapes. We can eat all the raisins we want in our trail mix. We are not prohibited from wine. We are not prohibited from grape juice. We are not defiled when we touch any dead body. But our lives is also dedicated and committed to God's purpose, just like a Nazarite in a looser sense, just like Samson. And just like Samson, we all have the presence of the Spirit of God in us, stirring in us, empowering us, strengthening us, motivating us. But the tragedy of Samson's life is that it's still being repeated in our lives. His self-destructive behaviors are still repeated in the lives of many, many. We are still going to the wrong places. We are still looking for the wrong things. We are still acting like we were 40, 50 years ago. We are still ignoring our fatal flaws. And what can we do? What can we do to stop this repetition of tragedy? First, we can acknowledge our fatal flaws and deal with it. Unless we deal with it, we will always come back and it will always bring us defeat. Samson's flaw was obvious. He was weak before women. It was also obvious that he never dealt with it. He ignored his fatal flaws. He allowed it to defeat him again and again. But the question that we need to ask this morning is, it defeated him, but it did it totally disable him? It did not. Look with me at the very last verse of chapter 15. Verse 20 in chapter 15 tells us that Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. 20 years God used him to be a judge among Israel. 20 years is a long time. For 20 years, his flaws always lay dormant. But because he never dealt with it decisively, it always came back and dealt him the greatest defeat. And at the end of these 20 years, Delilah came into his life. We all have our fatal flaws. We all have our own Maginot line. We may be so strong, we may be so indestructible. We may be so impregnable in so many areas of our Christian life. We may know all the answers to all the questions that were brought up in Sunday school. We may go to every Bible study. We may go to every prayer meetings. We may go and participate in every visitation. The Maginot line in our Christian life may look so good and so strong. But our enemy, Satan, knows where there is an opening. Where he can outflank our defenses, where he can sneak up behind us. We all need to ask ourselves this question. What is our fatal flaw? Acknowledge it and deal with it and turn away from it. Unrest, this downward slide to different degrees of self-destructive behaviors and reverse it. This is the hardest part of our discipleship. This is the hardest part about growing in maturity in Christ. It is not because the Bible is so difficult to understand that is why we are not growing in faith. It is not because the sermons are so boring that we are not growing in faith. It is because we all avoid dealing with the real issues in our lives. Every one of us dread to confront and deal with our fatal flaws. We all have our marginal mentality. We all say to ourselves, I am okay. I am strong in the faith. I am invulnerable. We all say the enemy could not attack me and could not defeat me. The enemy would not sweep down through my Belgium. We all say, I am saved just the way I am because I like the way I am. And the whole world tells us to like the way we are. All the time we are defeated like friends in just 6 weeks. What is your fatal flaw? I know mine. Could it be pride and arrogance? Just listen to what you say all the time. Just listen to what you think all the time. It betrays the flaws of pride and arrogance. Could it be discipline or lack of it? Could it be inconsistency? And the list goes on and on. And we all have our own list. Don't wait until the enemy has occupied your life. Don't wait until you go down in shame and defeat. And don't wait until you wake up one day and you didn't even know what hit you. That's exactly what Samson did. He was hit so hard and he woke up and he didn't even know what hit him. Look with me down in chapter 16, verse 20. Let's read that together. We did not read that earlier. Verse 20. Let's read verse 20 together, please. Samson awoke from his sleep and thought, I will go out as before and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. What gave him the strength? It wasn't his hair. Hair has no magical power. His hair was only a representation that God was with him when his hair was on his head. The real reason he was defeated was not that his hair was cut. The real reason why he was defeated at the end, because God is saying, enough is enough. I am no longer with you. My favor is no longer with you. Talk about being clueless in our spirituality. Please don't be clueless to why one of these days we wake up and we didn't even know what hit us. Don't be clueless in waking up one day and figure and wonder, how did I get myself into this mess? There's another thing we can do to stop repeating the same tragedy. That is to break the cycle of provocation and revenge. If you notice that all through Samson's life, there is this cycle of provocation and revenge. The Philistine provoked him by answering his riddle. So he sought revenge by killing 30 Philistines. His father-in-law provoked him by giving his bride to other men in the wedding party. And so, Samson sought revenge by tying 300 foxes together, tail to tail, and lit torches and tied it together in the tails and sent them off in the field. The Philistine provoked Samson by burning his wife and father-in-law to death. So Samson sought revenge by killing 1,000 of them with the jawbones of a donkey. So the cycle of provocation and revenge goes on and on and on and on. Maybe that is your fatal flaw. You are constantly provoked by someone or by something. And you always seek how to get even. But whatever it is and whoever it is, you couldn't break the cycle of this provocation and revenge. What could we do? At the end of this chapter, at the end of the story of Samson, it tells us to trust in God's grace and to live by God's grace. Who is the hero in Samson's story? Certainly not Samson. He was a tragic figure. The real hero is God himself. Samson never changed, and yet God still used him to lead Israel for 20 years. Samson did not deserve his position, and yet Samson and God said, "You are still my man." God's grace in his life sustained him all those years, and even at the end when his eyes were gouged out. He was blinded, he was deported to Gaza, and he had to endure the greatest of humiliation. The Philistines set him to grinding in the prison. There were still some string left in him, so the Philistine harnessed him to a mill and have him walk around and around and around like an animal grinding out mill grain. Even at the death of his shame and defeat, God's grace never left him. God's grace still shined forth in the darkness of the prison. The strongest man ever there was fell to such depth of shame and defeat and humiliation, all because of his own self-destruction. And when he hit bottom, he turned around and he discovered God's grace was still his. Verse 28, Samson said, the Bible says Samson prayed to God and he said, "Oh, sovereign Lord, remember me." Now, doesn't that remind you of a prayer of somebody else in the Bible? That's exactly what the repentant criminal who was nailed next to Jesus said. "Remember me." God always listened to prayers of repentant sinners who asked God for forgiveness and remembrance. And God did. And we all know what happened next. There's nothing heroic about Samson. All he did was to shed light on God's grace. Our gracious God who forgives. Our gracious God who remembers. God is the hero. And he is still at work in our days, in our time, and in our world to hear the prayers of all those who will cry out to him, "Forgive and remember." And God will hear, and God will salvage such life. Samson's life was a tragic life because there were so many could-haves. Samson's life was a tragic life because he brought it upon himself. But his life does not need to be repeated. God's grace does not depend on our performance. Many things in life depend on our performance. But God's grace does not depend on our performance. Samson's performance certainly was not praiseworthy. But when Samson came back to God, he was still shackled. He was still blind. God never healed him. But Samson came back to God, still blind. But he came back crying to God, and God accepted his cry. And if you will cry out to God, God will listen to you too, and God will accept you too. Anyone who will come back to God, God always accepts. Let's all stand together. Let's not wait.